The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. A sunny Thursday in Southern California. And holy mackerel, is the LA sports scene thriving right now. I never thought I would say those words, but six playoff games in the next 4 days. Kings tonight, Lakers tomorrow, doubleheader Saturday, Clippers-Lakers, which has never happened in the history of mankind. And then Sunday, Kings, 12 o'clock, Clippers, 7:30. Yeah, that's how it goes. And if the Kings game goes into like triple overtime, that Clippers game could be starting at 11 p.m. Now, one person who's on the phone line right now who doesn't care about any of this is a guy who has not had his team be in the NBA playoffs since Dr. J was only at about 9 kids. Now he's at like 30. Mike Lombardi, what's happening?
Not much. I'm not sure we're really in it anyway. When you watch the 76ers and you realize that everywhere they've turned, they've had the greatest breaks in the history of sports and they've advanced, but you know, I hope it doesn't dilute their mindset on how they actually have to fix the team.
Yeah, so you got in round one, Derrick Rose blows out his knee at the end of a game one blowout. Then right as Chicago feels like they finally are going to at least be in together and win the round one series anyway, Noah's ankle does a 90-degree angle. And still, you need almost a miracle ending in game six to get out of to avoid a game seven in Chicago. Then you go round two, Pierce playing on one leg, Bradley has one arm, Rayon can't walk, Steemsma, who had been really valuable for the Celtics, is, you know, he can't move, and the Sixers are down 2-1. Like, it does feel like they've caught every break for 4 straight weeks here.
No question. I mean, you know, and they're a team who relies on jump shots and can't make jump shots. I mean, that's the beautiful thing. You know, I mean, it's amazing how they were even able to win 4 games against Chicago and win, you know, win a game against Boston. I mean, when you go back and watch some of those Chicago games, they were painful.
You are a big motivation coach philosophy guy. Doug Collins has been the Sixers coach. This is his second year now, and there is nobody who's vacillated between, you know, like a real motivator leader guy and then the other side of it, which is he's just full of BS. And people kind of go back and forth on how they feel about him. Where does Mike Lombardi stand on Doug Collins?
I think Doug is, you know, I really like what he's been able to do. I think he's like a lot of coaches that sees the game through the coach's eyes. Like, for example, you know, this Vinkovic kid is it Vinkovic or Yukovic or Nico, the center from USC? One of those three, random check.
It's a bitch.
You know, he plays them during the season, but yet now that we need a big guy, he's nowhere to be found because he hasn't played him enough to get ready to beat the teams you ultimately have to beat. But yet we play a guy like Jody Meeks the entire season, but yet he's no good for the teams when you have to play a team that you have to beat. So,
yeah.
You know, that's the difference between being a coach and being a guy with vision. And I think ultimately Doug is a good coach, but somebody needs to be in the organization giving him some sense of vision and some sense of who we have to beat to move forward.
Yeah, if I was a Sixer fan this year, the most important thing to me would have been the development of Evan Turner. And that's all I really would have cared about. All this other stuff is ancillary. God, I can't speak. But Evan Turner, the ceiling of this team is wherever Evan Turner takes it at this point, until Elton Brand's contract comes off and they can figure out what to do with that extra money. But he is the most talented player in the team. He is somebody who actually has shown a propensity to rise to the occasion. As a Celtic, you know, I think it's always interesting when you judge your own players by how the other team's fans feel about those players when they're going against them. And I can tell you, like, in game two, I was terrified of Evan Turner taking the basket. I thought that was the single scariest person on the floor for Philly. And for whatever reason, yeah, I mean, were you happy with how he handled Turner this year?
No, not at all. And I think he, you know, I think that every time, like last night, when things are bad and the team doesn't play well, Turner comes out and Meeks goes in. It's like everything is always Turner. It ends up being Turner when essentially, you know, that's the reason why you picked him second was because you want to build a team around him, not because you think you need Jody Meeks on the court at a certain time. And I'm disappointed because the only time in the Chicago game we could get a rebound was when Turner was on the court. And yet we didn't have him on there, and they had 77 chances at a second shot late in the game, and there's Turner sitting next to Collins. So, but I think it's a global issue here. I think it happens in every sport where the coaches see how can they win the next game as opposed to having vision for preparing the team for whoever we have to beat. This goes back to Tom Landry. When Tom Landry was the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys in his first year, he played the flex defense, and you know, and they wanted him to change out of the flex, and he said to them, look, when we're good, we're going to be good playing the flex. When we're bad, that's when we're going to learn how to play the flex. And I think that goes with saying, I mean, they don't play the young players early in the season to make the playoffs, and then when you need the big seven-footer, he's sitting on the bench with no play time, and you have to play LaVoie Allen, who's a nice player, because you realize the reality of the situation is they have no power in their game. I mean, Elton Brand is done. I mean, I think that's pretty much universally accepted. So who else can they go to a low post game that could score a basket when they need one? They don't.
Well, and then the Celtics finally figured out in game three that if Philly was going to go small, he'd just go to the rim. Because they have no shot blockers.
None.
I don't know why they didn't figure that
Philly,
out in game one
only,
or two. But
Philly's the greatest 6'6 and under team in the league.
Yeah.
Because they basically have a bunch of guys that are all the same. This is Philly's in a lesson on how not to build a team in terms of having too many of the same players. Because you can never have interchangeable, you never have enough versatility within your game. And so therefore they have these 6'7 guys that all are interchangeable, but they all do the same thing.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the Turner thing plays out. I really think he's good. And what I like about him is even when he's not playing well, he can still do other things to help you win. You know, he can go 2-for-13 and still have a major impact on a game, which I think is a good quality.
But he rubs the head coach the wrong way. It's pretty clear because whenever things go bad with the team, he's always the first guy pulled.
Yep.
He's always, you know, he always does something that maybe me as a football guy can't see on the basketball court, but there's something he does wrong that alienates Collins, and next thing you know, I got to watch Jody Meeks run around, and then I got to watch Lou Williams, who really, you know, who finished the second in the six-man award, and it's great to shoot jumpers, but if Lou Williams would commit himself to 10 free throws a game and drive to the rim, he wouldn't have to be a six-man.
Yeah. Hey, our guy Mark Titus, who played with Turner in Ohio State and had a love-hate relationship with him, which he's written about over the years in a very funny way, called him the villain. And Turner's not an easy guy to get along with, I don't think. I think his heart's in the right place, but I do think he has some personality quirks, and we know Collins has some personality quirks. So, have you been watching the rest of the playoffs or just Philly?
I love it. I love watching it because to me it just proves the only way you could get better with your own team. And people say, well, you know, you're just not really a Sixer fan. You just like to rag on them. Well, you have to watch the level of competition. That's great. It's like teams that draft players that start for them. I mean, it's one thing for guys to start for the Colts. Another thing to start for the Oklahoma Thunder, you know?
Right.
And so you have to watch the other games to really value how good your players are. Like, you see all the games. Thaddeus Young doesn't play well in any of the playoff games. Is he a legitimate player you build a team around? I mean, those are the questions you have to ask. Or is he just a compartment player that fits a perfect niche? I think that's the only way you can learn that is by watching all the other games. It's what Bill Walsh used to talk about. It's scouting inside out, not outside in.
And I think, you know, when you're comparing football to basketball, the Spurs are the most the Spurs have the most elements of what would make a successful football team. And they, you know, the comparison's been made a billion times, but Belichick and Brady versus Popovich and Duncan, you can really find a lot of similarities between that and the system and how to fit certain people and a certain type of player and a certain type of character person. Wouldn't you agree? Like, they're much more similar than maybe we think a football and basketball team should be.
I think they're identical, and I would add Bobby Cox into the mix because I think those three gentlemen, Cox in baseball, Popovich in basketball, and Belichick, they operate their basket, they operate their team as if they were the general manager and the coach. They have a vision for their team, and they don't manage the team on a day-to-day basis. And you talked about leadership and all that. Managers do the right thing. Leaders do things right. I mean, managers do things right, leaders do the right thing. And if you're a leader of a basketball team, you're going to make sure your team's ready to beat the competition when you have to play it.
Yeah.
And you see that with Popovich. You see Bobby Cox did it with the Braves in baseball. And Belichick does it in football. And so when you have a coach who thinks like a GM but is also can think like a coach, that's the perfect – that's utopia. And I think that's where Doug, when you go back to the 76ers, I think he coaches the team – because he wants chemistry in the locker room. He wants, they made no trade at the deadline. Here's a team that has a bunch of role players that didn't get a superstar. They could have made a trade at the deadline, but he didn't want to upset the chemistry of the locker room. Now, do you think Popovich or do you think Belichick would worry about the chemistry?
Right. And, so I went back to New York City this week because we had the ESPN upfronts. And Tyson Chandler was there. And, because they brought him out as part of the thing. So there was like 3 hours of dead time behind before everything started, and they made everybody get there too early for rehearsal. So I was talking to Tyson Chandler for probably 20 minutes with Skip Bayless and Stephen A, because Stephen A knew Tyson. It was definitely one of the more bizarre four-way conversations I've had. And Tyson was talking about how he's still really upset that Dallas let him go, which he's talked about publicly, so I don't feel like I'm betraying his confidence talking about this. He just felt like he was a huge part of that championship team, that championship teams should be kept together, if you can do it. And he wanted to come back. He was willing to take a bit of a discount. And from the moment they won the title, it was just clear to him that Dallas wanted no part of bringing him back. They wanted the cap space. And what bothered him was that they never went to him and said, hey, we're going to move in a different direction here. We love what you did. We want you to succeed. We hope you do well somewhere else, but this is just how we're doing it. He never felt like they handled it that way. And the reason I'm saying this is because he said, I think of how a team like the Spurs would have handled it. It would have been totally different. They would have come to me like a man and said, look, we love what you did. Thank you. We're going in a different direction now. But we wanted to be up front with you and just tell you why we're doing this. And he said that's the difference between the two organizations. But it was interesting to me that somebody who had never played for the Spurs had that much respect for the Spurs, which made me think, when you handle your business the right way as a franchise, all the other players, even the guys who never end up playing with you, they all catch wind of this, right?
No question. And I think what that also says is the great organizations don't mind confrontation. It's always difficult to sit a player in your office and be honest with them. They don't want to hear what you're going to have to say, but if you say it, because nobody wants to be the bad guy. Everybody wants to say, well, the owner wanted to get rid of him, or this guy wanted to go, or whatever happened here. Nobody really wants to be the bad guy. And I think that when you look at the Patriots, Belichick has no problem with confrontation. I think Popovich has no problem with confrontation. And so when you're honest with players, I think the players really respect you more, even though you're saying things that perhaps they don't want to hear, just exactly what you talked about with Tyson Chandler.
Yeah, and it's funny because he was talking about this, and when they traded Richard Jefferson was a guy that San Antonio spent a lot of time working with, and he came in, he just didn't fit. And I think two summers ago, Popovich decided the best way this guy can help us is to make corner threes. And he went and he worked with Jefferson himself on corner threes. Like, he rebounded for him and just banged it into his head, that's a shot I need you to make for us to win. And Jefferson did really well from corner threes. His percentages went way up the whole thing. Then this year they decide, oh, we have a chance at Steven Jackson here. They did the right thing. They went to Jefferson, and Jefferson even talked about it after the trade. Like, yeah, they came to me. They showed me a lot of respect. They told me why they're doing the trade. No hard feelings. I love my time there. It just seems like that's the way everybody should handle business. I don't understand why this isn't rocket science. Why did so many people mess this up?
Well, because nobody wants to be the bad guy, Bill. I mean, nobody wants to be in the morning paper saying, you know, they told this player, and then nobody really trusts their instincts on the evaluation. Because what happens if you say to Tyson Chandler, you know, we really don't want you, and he goes out and he makes you look bad? I think part of that is why the 76ers won't make a trade, because they're afraid that all these role players that they've assembled will go to some other team that has a superstar and become really good, and everybody in Philadelphia said, well, why wasn't he doing that for us? When you miss the biggest point. The point is, if the Sixers had a true superstar on their team, every player they had would look a lot better. And yeah. So there's that moment where people won't want to make a decision because they're afraid they're going to get lambasted for it and become wrong. And I think that's why people always are trying to pass the buck around, say, well, I really didn't want to do it. Happens in football all the time. You cut a player, nobody wants to tell the player he was no good. Everybody wants to tell him, you know, I would have kept you, but, you know, this guy, they didn't really like you.
Right.
You know, that doesn't really get you far as an organization.
What football teams do you feel like have that respect within the league as a team that treats their players the right way?
Well, I think look at the Giants. I mean, look what they went through with Osu Minora this offseason. They win a Super Bowl. They have him in the locker room. He's complaining about his contract. They went about their business. They've had Plexico Burress in their locker room. Coughlin was able to handle that. I think, you know, one thing about Coughlin, one thing about Mike Tomlin, one thing about these guys, if you know where they are and they're consistent on where they are, you have a better path of moving forward. But if they're always changing, if the paradigm's always shifting because of the player, then you can't ever get a good grasp on it, and it changes, and you really have the players have no understanding of where things are coming from, and that creates the biggest problem.
We haven't talked since the NFL draft, which I'm trying to think. I mean, things went pretty much like we expected. I guess maybe the Patriots trading up and going after two blue-chip defensive guys. Can you think of anything else that jumps out at you looking back a couple weeks later of big events from that draft?
You know, no, I think obviously all the trades that happened, but we knew that was going to happen because of the new salary cap, because of the new rookie pool. I mean, now rookie signing are no longer, it's become the NBA where you're no longer sweating out a rookie contract. The guy's going to sign it and move forward. So
yeah.
We saw a lot of trades. We saw a lot of teams try to move around. And I think what you saw to me in the draft were the really good teams got better, and the bad teams, I'm not sure, did improve. And I think you're seeing in the National Football League, you're going to continue to see a have and have not era. I think there's going to continue to be a separation between the really good teams and the teams that just don't seem to quite get it all together. Because again, it comes back to what's the draft? The draft is about figuring out what you need and what's really wrong with your football team, not what you believe is wrong with your team. It's the illusion of validity. I mean, when you really think you need something, when the reality is like the Atlanta Falcons, we're just one receiver away from being a great team, and you go yeah. trade your whole draft for it, that really worked out well for them. So, you know, I think that's what the draft's all about. And because that's such an important mechanism in building your team, if you don't have that right, it's hard to rebuild your team.
The most, I don't know if this was the funniest or the tragically funniest or whatever, but the Rams start out at number two. They make a great trade with Washington to six. But then it seems like the guy they wanted at six, Jacksonville jumped ahead of them and got him. So now they move backwards again. Now they're at 14. Basically, the sum of the story is it doesn't seem like they got anybody they want, and they were sitting there at number two. If they had to do that over again, what should they have done differently?
Well, I think, you know, they should have probably, you know, they thought, again, this is going to come out in the wash in terms of how well they evaluated. But I think the message they sent to their team, some of the players they're bringing into the locker room, they're saying to their team, we really don't care about the character. We're just going to bring a collection of players in here. They trade down to get Michael Brockers. Now, whether he can rush the passer and become a dominating pass rusher, that's what Fletcher Cox should be when 3 years from now when we have analyzed the draft. If that happens to be true, where Cox is a great rusher and Brockers is really just a rundown player, then what the Rams did wasn't prudent. And then I think when you start adding in some of the character issues that they put in their locker room, for a young team and a new team that's starting out, I think it's a little iffy. Now, if people say, well, Jeff Fisher's an experienced coach, he can handle it. Well, he couldn't handle Pac-Man Jones, and he was experienced in Tennessee. So I think there's some issues that they've got to deal with in their locker room. I'm not sure. They got a lot of players that have talent, but I'm not sure all the talent's going to come together.
What about Seattle spending money on Matt Flynn, which I actually agreed with. I think he's going to be pretty good. And then they draft a quarterback in the third round. They draft the 5'11" kid. And
yeah. And then
Pete Carroll goes and says
that they're going to let him compete for the starting job.
Yeah. So explain the philosophy of that sequence to me.
I can't explain it because football is a mathematical equation, and people don't understand this. And if you go to practice is never about like we were in high school. We're going to go out there for 2 hours today and practice. Football practice is all done by the amount of plays and the amount of reps each player gets to perform his job. So if we're a Seattle Seahawk offensive practice, totally there should be 70 reps in that practice. Of which Matt Flynn, who's an inexperienced player, even though he's been in the league 4 years, Tavarius Jackson, who is experienced but needs reps, of those 70 plays, those two probably are going to split them 45%. There's only going to be 10% of the reps left for Russell Wilson to come in and play. So how do you add another player to compete for the quarterbacking job when there's not enough reps to go around to get him ready to actually allow him to compete? So it really made no sense. And Mayock and I went back and forth at this on TV. Mike likes Russell Wilson, the player, which is wonderful to like him. But to me, that now falls into the category of collecting talent as opposed to building a team.
And
so
what
you
about,
can like the talent, but you're building a football team to win. And those two things have to be in harmony. And I don't think that pick was in harmony with that.
Yeah, and if I'm Matt Flynn, I'm like, what did I just do?
Because if I don't win the job, they're going to come to me and say I got to take a pay cut, which is really unfair because I didn't sign this contract thinking I wasn't going to win the job. I don't mind competing, but now all of a sudden I'm going to have to take a pay cut if I don't win it because you're going to say to me we have too much money at quarterback. You know, and therefore there starts to become the problem, which we talked about earlier in this conversation, was when you're not honest with the players, you know, then all of a sudden you lose trust in the locker room. Now, you know and I know that Matt Flynn was told he was going to be able to compete with Tavarius Jackson. He wasn't told he's going to also have to compete with Russell Wilson.
I see. I thought when they signed Matt Flynn, that was like, yeah, you're going to be our starting quarterback. Why would they have even signed him if he wasn't going to be the starting quarterback? I don't understand.
Because some teams think that the quarterback position is like the offensive guard position where you bring in competition and you allow it to set. And I'm not sure you do that. You have to make up your mind on who you want to develop. Quarterbacking is different than offensive guard. Offensive guards are competition positions. Quarterbacks are development positions. You have to develop the quarterback to become good. And you've got to be right with your ability to evaluate before you start developing. So, you know, obviously the teams that get in trouble are the ones that miss the evaluation as they go into the development stage. So offensive guards, it's about competition. We're going to bring in two guards, whether it's the guard from South Florida who ends up beating out the second-round draft pick, who knows? But they're competing, and whoever wins, wins. Quarterback can't really be built like that.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like by the end of April, you take the car keys and you throw it to a quarterback and you say, you're our guy. And you know, you might blow this in training camp, but just know that heading into the summer, this is your team. Seems like the way it should be done.
Only way it should be. It goes back to how are you going to get your team ready? It goes back to number of reps. I mean, Matt Flynn needs as many reps as he can get. Russell Wilson needs as many reps as he can get. And by the way, Tavarius Jackson needs as many reps as he can get. You can't handle that many things. You can't develop your team. We're not collecting talent. And I think that's what you see with the 76ers. They are a collection of talent. They're not built to be a good team. Whereas there's some teams, regardless of what you think about them, are built to be a good team. They may lack some areas in terms of the talent, but they're built, they have the right emphasis in the right areas. And you see that more in basketball. That's what makes basketball, to me, the most fascinating sport in terms of building the team. Because when you have to play left-handed, you better have an answer. And so last night, the Sixers couldn't run. They had to play half court. There's no answer. And so in football, it's the same thing, only it's harder for the fans to see how we get to that point.
Dallas traded up to take a cornerback that they had not even interviewed. And people seem to think this was a big deal, and he was surprised. Hey, is it a big deal? Do you have to interview somebody before you take them?
No, because, I mean, they did interview him. I mean, he went through the you know, all the teams talked to all the top players at the combine for the 15-minute
interview. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant work out. They didn't work him out.
No, I mean, look, they evaluated him. And, you know, they don't know what's going to happen in the draft. The draft is like taking a final exam. You don't know what the questions are going to be on the exam. You better make sure you do all the preparation. And the minute you think a guy's not going to be there, oh, by the way, good luck, he's going to be there. So you better make sure you do it, and every team's prepared for it. And look, everybody, including myself, thought that when they were going to trade up, they were trading up to get the safety, Mark Barron. But the reality was they never thought that Claiborne would be there. They got him,
yeah.
And they were prepared to get him.
Hey, coming out of that draft, now nothing really is going to happen for – you know, until training camp. So we know who the teams are now. We know who the contenders are. Do you feel like there is just a definite favorite at this point?
No, I think it's always a cluster. You know, look, we've seen two guys get Achilles injuries here that affect their teams greatly. I mean, Jason Peters affecting the left tackle position. You know, that hurts Philadelphia. I know they signed DeMarcus Bell, but, the reality is I think Bell's not as good a player as Peters, and that's going to hurt them in the long run. And then, you know, you look at the team like the Baltimore Ravens that lose Terrell Suggs. That's 14 and a half sacks. He got three sacks. He had three games with three sacks. I mean, you don't find a guy to replace him. You know, those guys aren't walking down the street. So when you look at teams, I think the good teams will stay good. I thought Dallas was, you know, and I said this on the air, Dallas was 8-8, and they were picking high. But really, when you break the Dallas Cowboys season down, if Miles Austin can find the ball in the lights and they can make a field goal, they're not an 8-8 team. They eliminate the Giants from the playoff picture. So I thought that they've improved because of what they were able to do, in spite of the fact that they lost all that cap money.
And you think Minnesota stays, thank God. Did not want
the Minnesota fans are great all over the place, and you would just only hope that they would be able to recognize the value of having a team, especially downtown at a stadium.
So they're staying, definitely.
It appears that way.
Yeah. So who is the leader in the Los Angeles sweepstakes then?
Well, you know, that's always hard to handicap, but the Rams obviously are the next team that are going through some stadium issues. They put a proposal in front. I think they have the right to have improvements made to their stadium. I think they just put $900 million, I think was the number I read. So certainly St. Louis, and then of course you got the two the California teams, whether it's the Raiders or whether it's the Chargers, that could go into the market. But you have to believe that the Los Angeles market, which is now, you know, obviously the Clippers good, the Kings good, like you started this conversation with, could use a football team to make the falls, even though with SC and UCLA playing football, I think even better.
I got to ask you about Seau. Stunning news, and yet when a football player takes his own life at this point, you know, the default mechanism is just to assume that it was concussions. And, you know, it revived the whole concussion debate, which has been something that's been going strong now for 20 months here with the NFL. What are you hearing now that this has died down a little bit? What are you hearing about the ramifications? And
well, I just hope we don't always just assume it was because of concussions. And look, Junior Seau was a tremendous, had the pleasure of being his company. He was on Inside the NFL on Showtime a couple times. Wonderful man. Watched him play at the Raiders so many years and was such a great player. That I just hope that we don't always just assume it was because of the concussion-based syndrome, then we have to dig a little deeper. I think the core issue here is we as a league, the National Football League and a society, we have to do a better job of helping players transition from the game to the real world. And, you know, in the 60s and the 70s when guys were working life insurance and playing football at the same time because football wasn't as lucrative, it was an easier transition. But today, you know, I read a stat online that over 90% of the players who've made $90 million have made $15 million in their career are bankrupt. 90% of the players that made $15 million are bankrupt. That's a staggering number. And I think we have to do a better job as a league and as an organization to help players transition from the game to the real world and understand what it takes to really survive in the real world. And I think that's as much a part of a problem as the concussion. Certainly we have to address that as well.
And that's something that, you know, one of our first 30 for 30s is called Broke. And that's a big thing. You know, it's not just the NFL. It's the NBA has been really hurt by this as well, and baseball to a lesser degree. But, you know, this is almost a plague. That just people running out of money who thought they had a lot more money than they actually did and spent some of it the wrong ways and made some mistakes. And, you know, they're 35 years old. They've made $25 million bucks and none of it's left. And I think you're right. I don't think they do a good enough job transitioning these guys. They have, you know, I think they'll have like a 2-hour big meeting with all the rookies, but it's not like they have consultants that stay with them the whole time. I don't know. It really does seem like we really need to reinvent this whole infrastructure and figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, look, people think, well, you know, a guy makes $5 million a year playing football. Well, that $5 million's got to last him for a long time because he's not earning $5 million for 20 years. He's not working for ExxonMobil. You know, he's working for the NFL, and his life expectancy in the league is 4 to 6 years. Perhaps he gets 8 years and two contracts. So, you know, that money's going to last him a long time and help his retirement and all those issues. People miss the boat, you know. And some of the players think that they're going to make $5 million for the rest of their lives. And unless they have good financial advice, sometimes they don't. But, look, the real estate market in a country has bankrupted a lot of people because of the decline. And I think a lot of players invested in that. And I think like a lot of Americans did, and I think a lot of players, we saw Mark Brunell have to declare bankruptcy because of it, because he invested in some properties, and I think there's been a lot of players that have been snake-bitten, much like a lot of Americans have as well.
Do you feel, you know, you're in contact with a lot of ex-players, do you feel like something like the sale thing happens? What's the fear level of these guys? Maybe guys that haven't suffered a lot of the ramifications yet, or the, you know, severe headaches, things like that, but they see something like that happen to Seau and they start thinking to themselves, am I next? Is this like 6 weeks from now? Am I going to be in the shower and all of a sudden I'm just going to feel super depressed and start having terrible thoughts? Like, do you feel like these guys are thinking about this stuff?
You know, I that's a hard one to answer. I hope they don't, and I hope that there's somebody that they could reach out. I mean, Randy Cross had a great tweet the other day about, hey, if you're feeling that way, don't take matters in your own hand. Call somebody and reach out for help. Don't be a macho man and think it's you know, reaching for help's a bad thing. And I think that's true. We have to do a better job of educating the players once they leave. That's a tough transition. I mean, you go from being a star athlete, where, you know, you get introduced in front of 75,000 people and, you know, millions at home, and the next thing you know, you're walking down and really people have forgotten who you are. And there's got to be a bigger a core of who you are to help you transition. And unfortunately, sometimes that's not the case. And I think it's going to be continually going to become a problem.
Yeah, I ended up not writing about the Seau thing, but I did mess around with something I was thinking about writing, just ended up not, just never got there. But I think there were a lot of pieces of this puzzle, and to just say it was concussions, I don't know if you could just blindly say, yeah, that was the reason. There might have been 8 reasons. You know, this is a guy that was probably the most famous person on his football team since he was what, 14, and even at the last few years of his career. Was still playing on the Patriots, you know, the big spotlight on him, was a hugely popular player. And for a lot of these guys, it's not just about the spotlight, but it's about being on a team and being with these, being with your teammates and these friendships that you make and just the day to go into practice and busting each other's balls and just that whole life. It's just, you know, some of these guys think there's just nothing better. And then when it ends, you're just sitting there on a beach and you're looking at the waves and you're wondering, man, I really miss playing football. And then maybe that was part of it. Maybe he had, you know, maybe he's addicted to pain meds, or maybe he took more pain meds than we realized. Maybe that was part of it. Maybe he was miserable with his marriage. Maybe that was part of it. Maybe he was, you know, going broke and we don't know about that part. Like, we just don't know. So that's why I just feel weird about writing a piece about it when we don't have enough information in. I don't feel like I have enough information to try to figure out what happened to this guy. Do you?
No, I don't think anybody does. I think anybody who would write that they did, or and even people close to him, I'm not sure really did, because there's a lot of things that go on into doing this drastic decision that he made. I just don't think it's an impulsive thing. Obviously, he drove off that cliff that one time, unfortunately, so there was a signal there that he wasn't happy with what's going on in his life. And it's just tragic, but I agree. You know, this is the one area of sports that was a lot easier in the 60s than it is today, because back then, like I said, you weren't always defined as a football player. You were defined as a husband, a father, you know, an insurance salesman who played football. And now today, you know, your life's defined by being a football player, and when you don't have that, you lose your definition and it becomes very difficult.
Yeah, and we also don't know the physical toll. I mean, nobody played no defensive player certainly played harder than Junior Seau did, and was he can't even imagine how many hits he was in on. And then, yeah, I just find it hard to believe that your body just rebounds from that. And he might have been in a lot of pain. And I don't know. This is why I just didn't feel right about writing about it. I want to know more of the facts. I am interested to see if they end up studying his brain, like what kind of effects, you know, they'll find with that. And I do think they've gotten a lot better at figuring out the kind of damage that you could have had from multiple concussions or whatever. I thought it was an interesting point. Somebody said, I forget which player was saying how going, you know, in the future, we're so much better at diagnosing concussions now that, you know, maybe 20 years from now, this isn't as much of an issue because we're so much more protective than we were. But that doesn't save us from all the guys that just finished playing. You know, and I think it's going to be an awkward transition. Do you feel like this is the biggest crisis the league has ever had?
Yeah, I think it's the one where we have to put the most focus and the most attention on, and player health and player safety. But look, the players, you know, have to do a better job themselves. They have to wear their mouthpieces. They should wear knee pads. They should wear, you know, they should do the things that help their bodies protect themselves a little bit more. And when the league tried to mandate those protection devices, whether it's wear knee braces, wear mouthpieces and knee pads, you know, it was voted down. So I think you can't have it both ways. You got to do a better job of protecting the players, which we did last year by the calls. You saw it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think we got to do it more with equipment, better helmets, and you, and basically utilize your pads, wear your pads.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly not a fun thing to talk about, but, it's just the reality of the situation now, and I think it is a dominant. It is the dominant football story. And what's going to be interesting is when we hit September and everybody's excited about the season, everybody's excited about fantasy football, and everybody's excited about betting and all the other fun stuff that happens when football starts going to games. I do wonder if this gets swept under the rug or not. I wrote about this in March. You know, it's easy to. Talk about all this stuff and get all pious about it when there's no football, but let's see if you're still talking about it on Sundays when there's 10 hours of games in a row. I wonder if we sweep it under the rug a little bit. And, you know, I feel a little guilty myself that this is a sport that I love watching, and obviously there's something a little bit wrong here, and it seems like we're trying to fix it, but then something like Seau happens and you wonder, you know, could we be doing more? What aren't we doing? And I think that's going to be the dominant question over the next couple of months. I guess the only other story, the Saints thing's pretty weird. They're almost a 30 for 30 documentary at this point, all the stuff that's happened to that team. Do you see any chance they can compete this year as a contender?
I just don't think it's all can come together. I mean, look, you know, Sean Payton not being there is there's a reason he's called the head coach. And I don't think anybody can come in and fill his shoes and do it as well as he did. I mean, look, I think what we'll find out this time next year is most people in New Orleans will say, you know, losing Sean was a huge blow. And we knew it at the time, but we didn't realize it. I think you're going to find that. And I think it's going to be difficult for them to have all this come together and the synergy in the locker room. Now, they have the one thing they have going for them is us against you mentality. And they can utilize that. But I think it's going to be difficult, especially since the one of the us is Drew Brees, and they haven't gotten him under contract. And
right.
They better figure out a way to do that.
Bizarre, by the way. What's the point of haggling with Drew Brees?
That's the one I don't understand. And talking to people, they've offered him a lot less, you know, money than what Peyton got in his last contract with Denver. You know, they don't want to seem to acknowledge that he's in the same era that Peyton got, didn't get as much guarantee as what Mario Williams received in his contract with the Buffalo Bills. So, I mean, I think New Orleans is driving a hard bargain here. Whether that's the right thing to do, I don't agree with it. There's sometimes, I know owners don't necessarily agree, but there's sometimes when a player does his contract that he certainly puts him in a level to where it really shouldn't be a hard contract to do. I mean, Drew Brees is at the top five players at his position. The debate is how close should he get to Tom Brady and Peyton Manning when they're at their prime, and I think that really, that becomes the issue. That becomes the negotiating point.
Either it makes me think physically he's in worse shape than maybe we know. You know, nobody knows the health of their own players, or nobody knows the health of a player better than the people that work with that player day in and day out. And he did have that shoulder thing. You know, maybe they know something.
But I think he's, you know, he's been healthy at the last game we saw him play. I mean, he took the team up and down the field. I think he doesn't want to have to play and subject himself to the one-year contract, which I completely understand. I mean, the last time he did that, he ended up with, I think, 37 staples in his shoulder. So,
right.
And one team, and only one team passed him on the physical. And I've said this numerous times. Nick Saban's still the head coach of the Miami Dolphins if the Dolphins doctors let him stay there, passed him on the physical.
Yeah, I side with football players in this one. If you're signing me to a year-to-year contract in a sport where my career could end any season and, you know, my window to make money isn't that much and you've already probably gotten a pretty good deal on me anyway, then pay up. You know, it's not like Josh Smith on Atlanta, who's in the last year of his contract, I think $12 million for that year. I don't feel bad for Josh Smith. He's going to sign another contract and make more money, and he doesn't have to worry about his career ending, you know, with one hit. And I think somebody like Wes Welker, that guy, he's one cut away from missing another season and being a $2 million guy.
Yeah, I don't think this goes back. When you have a superstar, you can't really overpay the superstar, assuming that you've correctly evaluated him to be the superstar. The players that get you in trouble are the one you play the mid-level players too much money. When you pay the replaceable parts too much money. I would rather be hard and sturgeon on a guy that was replaceable than the guy that isn't replaceable. I think that's where you become a little bit freer with the money in terms of you make sure you get the great player signed, assuming he's great. But where teams get in the most trouble, and I've made the mistake as well, is when we mistakenly think a player's great and pay him like he's great. Andre Iguodala is not a great player, but he's paid like one. Elton Brand is not a great player, but he's paid like one. So when the box score comes in and you're Rod Thorne of the Philadelphia 76ers and you see your payroll, and now I know Collins loves Iguodala, but at what point do you say we're not getting our bang for our buck here?
Well, Rudy Gay is another example. Carlos Boozer, obviously, is a
and he didn't play the last half of the game. I mean, you know, he did, in the most crucial game, he sat on the bench. I mean, to me, Thibodeau told you right there what he thought of that situation.
Right. So you're saying Wes Welker is replaceable, or am I reading between the lines?
Well, I'm saying Wes Welker is a player that now he signed his tender. What I'm saying Wes Welker is very difficult to replace as a slot player. Very difficult.
Yeah.
But I also have to be realistic that I know what the market is. He's not Calvin Johnson, you know.
Yep.
And he's entitled to a good 3-year contract at a really good number, but I don't think he's just because the number of catches doesn't put him into Calvin Johnson's era.
Right.
And you can't. So, you have to be careful there. And, you know, that's where I think teams make the most mistakes. And you see it in basketball all the time. It happens in football all the time. But in football, there's always a readjustment. The guy who gets overpaid always gets cut the next year.
The problem is in basketball, you can only play 5 guys. And the importance of those 5 guys can seem skewed artificially. And sometimes it is easy to look at numbers. The guy's playing 40 minutes a game. He's averaging a 20-10 like Boozer did. But the reason he's doing that is because he's playing with Darren Williams and he's playing 40 minutes a game. You're going to get to those numbers are close. I think Chris Bosh is another example.
Well, like Kyle Korver. Why would Kyle Korver – why would somebody ever pay Kyle Korver all that money?
Well, he makes, what, $5 million a year? Because you're thinking to yourself, we need outside shooting. We have to overpay for this. Usually the free agents get overpaid by 25%.
But he's the player that you should never overpay.
True.
Because in San Antonio, they're trying to develop Richard Jefferson for the shot in the corner as opposed to paying $5 million for that guy.
Yeah, I think Oklahoma City is a really good example of how to approach this. They've hoarded their cap space. And, you know, really the only possible misstep they made was they overpaid Perkins by maybe $1.5 million a year. But other than that, they put all their money behind Durant and Westbrook. They're going to re-sign Harden. They're going to re-sign Ibaka. And then they'll fill in the rest with role players because that's what San Antonio does. San Antonio has proven that they can find Danny Green, Gary Neal, Matt Bonner. They can find these guys every year and stick these guys into spots and build around the 3 or 4 guys that they care about. And that's how to do it.
I thought Bird won Executive of the Year, but look, he gets David West for $20 million for 2 years, wouldn't you rather have David West for $20 million for two than Elton Brand for $80 for five?
Yeah, but, you know, here's the thing with Elton, though. I was going to those games in 06. He was a top 7 or 8 player that year. You know, he averaged like a 20, I think like a 24-12 for the Clips and was going toe-to-toe with Nowitzki and Duncan. And, you know, it was legit. And then he tore his Achilles the next year. And I think if you could kill Philly on anything, it would be that they risked that much money on a guy who was coming off a pretty major basketball injury.
Because Achilles is something that just, you go through the time and place of the people that have had it, it's hard to overcome that injury.
Well, especially in basketball. I mean, from what I've heard, I've opinions are split on this, but from what I've heard, it's actually maybe even a little bit easier to come back from a torn ACL. Because your Achilles, you lose your spring. And once you don't have your spring and you're a power forward, you're in trouble. But anyway.
Yeah, there's no question he has no spring. There's no question he has it. But I think it goes back to, and this is why Belichick and I, back in Cleveland in 94, we went to the June camp in Chicago together, and we sat down with Jerry West. And the West advice to both of us at the time, and we were at that old gym, I think it's some Mooney Junior College or something where they had it. We were watching the basketball things going on. And Wes told us at the time, you know, always save your cap room. And it was like the most precious element that you could possibly ever have. And think long term, not always short term. And I think that advice holds up true today in every sport.
Last question, quick. Molly Lambert, Grantland's own, tweeted yesterday that Kobe was Don Draper in 1966. I said that made Oklahoma City Michael Ginsburg. Can we stretch that to say Tim Duncan's Roger Sterling, or am I taking it too far?
I like it. I like it a lot. I like it a lot. I do think Ginsburg is going to be a formidable opponent. I think he's going to have to move up in the power rankings at Grantland. There's no question. I think he's somebody to contend with. Because, you know, he's what Mark Twain always would call the unconventional swordsman. You know, the great swordsman never fears the second best one. He always fears the unconventional one, and Ginsburg's the unconventional one.
Well, there you go. We worked Mad Men in. Mike Lombardi, thank you for the time.
Bill.
Worst of luck with your Sixers.
It'll be over in 2 games. I'm going Friday night, by the way. I'll be there. I've committed to supporting my team.
Okay, good. I'm proud of you. Good luck. We'll talk to you later in the summer.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right, very quickly, we are going to call Connor Schell, the vice president of ESPN Films, my friend. He's been on the podcast before. One of the creators of 30 for 30, one of the executive producers of 30 for 30 Volume 2, which we just announced on Tuesday is going to happen. Let's talk about it with him. I think he'll be really mad that I did not tell him we were calling.
Hello.
What's happening?
How you doing?
You're on the podcast.
Very exciting. What's going on?
You hate when I call you on the podcast. I had to call because... we announced
I can't get 5 minutes of notice?
No, actually, no, you can't. And I know it'll bother you for the rest of the day. We announced a new 30 for 30 series on Tuesday at the ESPN Upfronts. That includes a short film component on Grantland.com. And if you missed it, BS Report listeners, the first one premiered on Tuesday, a short that we did about Pete Rose, directed by Eric Drath. And then the series will premiere in October. What kind of feedback have you been getting?
What a professional promo that was, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think we've gotten great feedback. You've gotten good feedback, right?
Yeah. People, I'm surprised. We live in an era where usually people aren't just unanimously cool with something, and it seems like in this case, there's no downside to 30 more sports documentaries that anybody can see, unless we screw it up somehow.
That's right. But if you don't like them, don't watch them, right? So
yeah,
there's no downside to it.
This is the fun part.
Genuinely, I hope that people are excited about this. I think when John Dahl and you and I and a bunch of other people here talked about this at the beginning, we always wondered if there was 30 stories to tell.
Yeah.
And now, like, what do you have, 500 ideas?
I know, we've been emailing, and it's funny, readers are sending ideas, and we're like, oh, that one's actually a pretty good one. And Yeah, the list is growing. It seems like we could probably do 100 for 100 pretty easily, but we're going to settle on 30. The other thing is, you know, when we did the first series, we weren't totally positive that, one, it was going to work, and two, that we're going to get to 30 stories. And now it just feels like, I feel like we can crank out 30 pretty easily here. And I think this series is going to be better than the first series, personally, because we know how to do it now, you know?
Good. And I like,
you don't agree?
I'm excited about the shorts. I thought that Eric's Pete Rose thing was really, really good and interesting and kind of unlike anything else that I've seen on the web lately.
Yeah,
and so I think that there's actually like a real possibility to do some stuff that's different.
Yeah, that was the big attraction, was we kind of felt like there was a little bit of a void. And the big thing that's changed in the last couple of years since we did the first series was, you can do the live streaming is just so much better now. You know, I think if we'd done this in 2009, there would have been fears about, well, how would people have played it? Can some people's computers handle it? You know, if it's an 8-minute film, it's just, you worried about that stuff 3 years ago. I don't think you worry about it anymore. And if anything, on the iPad, it looks great. You know, the computers are better. People have HD in their computers now. I actually thought it looked nice. Like, I enjoyed watching it. So hopefully we'll be able to keep cranking those out. But I'm excited. This is the best part.
So tell people to send you ideas.
Yeah, send us ideas.
Send you things they want to see.
What was the one I emailed you today? Somebody emailed me about Tommy Morrison. And I was like, oh, Tommy Morrison. That could be a good one.
You got emails about Tommy Morrison, about the Supersonics leaving.
Yeah, Aaron Pryor.
About a boxer that I hadn't heard of.
Aaron Pryor?
Yeah.
You've heard of Aaron Pryor. He fought Alexis Arguello. He was the member Panama Lewis gave him mixed the special drink for him. Wasn't that it?
No, I'm not a big boxing guy.
All right.
Can learn.
I'll chip in on boxing.
What else? You got another good email too. I don't remember what it was. The 87 Canada Cup.
Oh yeah. And then you know, the people from Seattle really want us to do the Sonics one, and I Sonics Gate, I felt like covered the Sonics thing pretty well. And I'm not sure if it would have to be a different angle. I'm not against it. You know, if Eddie Vedder came to us and said, I want to do a Sonics one, I think we could figure it out, Eddie. Eddie, come to us.
What's the precedent about a team leaving a city and then the new team creating a dynasty immediately afterwards?
Yeah, this is your big theory.
That story gets a whole new wrinkle when the Thunder win the title this year, right?
You think they can win the next five, the Zombie Sonics?
I think if they re-sign Harden, they're really, really good.
Yeah, last night certainly helped. Yeah, maybe that story morphs into something a little more interesting. The good thing is we're going to be doing these over. They launched this fall, 2013, April, and then the summer, and then the fall there. It's going to run all the way through 2014, so we have 2.5 years to figure this out. And we have a couple ones that are pretty much done already, right? Just promote the ones that are almost done quickly, and then you can go to your 3 o'clock meeting.
This is all promoting. Broke, which was done by Alfred Spellman and Billy Corbin, premiered at Tribeca.
By the way, Lombardi and I just talked about it.
They produced and directed the film The U. And this is about athletes and money and why athletes have a propensity to have money problems and some of the pitfalls. And it's not about any one story specifically. It's more like a composite of the issues that happen to someone in their 20s who all of a sudden is an instant millionaire.
Right.
And then a film that I love called Benji by two first-time documentary directors named Chike and Kuti, who are music video guys. The story is about a guy named Ben Wilson, who Sonny Vaccaro says is one of the 5 or 6 best high school basketball players he's ever seen, who tragically was killed during his senior season in 1984.
Yep.
And that also played at Tribeca, and I believe also is a very, very strong film. And it's a story that nobody knows.
And what's interesting is we were developing that for about a year, and then the Trayvon thing happened. And although it's a totally different story, there are some parallels to how that community reacted back then with Benji and now. And it kind of gave it I don't even know what to call it. It felt differently watching a cut after the Trayvon thing versus before. Do you agree?
I did. I think when we do these films correctly, and when the filmmakers tell these stories that sort of transcend the actual sports story they're telling, it's amazing how many times there's relevance in the news again and parallels where you see something happening all over again.
Yeah.
And particularly in this one also, you know, Ben Wilson was a star player at Simeon High School. He was the number one player in the country and won the state championship. And that happened again with Derrick Rose, and then it happened again this past year with Jabari Parker. And part of the film that I think gives it a kind of really interesting present-day relevance is that Jabari Parker, I believe, wears Ben Wilson's number at Simeon, and he has his number written into his shoe and really, yeah, like, knows the story and the legacy of this guy who preceded him. It's a good film.
And not just that, he's on the cover of Sports Illustrated this week.
He's on the cover of Sports Illustrated this week. That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have some good ones coming up. I'm excited, happy to be involved again, excited for the creative process, excited for the meetings, excited for the rough cuts. And people listening out there, keep sending us ideas. You never know.
Yeah, send Bill suggestions. It's where it is where the best ideas come from.
Yeah, and I guess the only other thing to mention is that the first series went from 1979 to 2009 because it was celebrating our 30-year anniversary. This time around, there's no year constraint. You know, if there's something that happened in 1969 that we feel like would potentially be a really good sports documentary, a good story, we would do it. So don't feel constrained by the years. But send us some ideas. You never know. Connor Schell, good luck with the 3 o'clock meeting that you're 5 minutes late for.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
So I get to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.